Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. As we roll into the end of June, the sports action continues to heat up with Major League Baseball, the UFC, Major League Soccer, and now the Women's World Cup. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet. Let's give big ups to Geico for being a loyal sponsor of the Steve Austin Show. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're gonna take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio. And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm glad to be back. We'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
What's good, everybody? It is producer Sean with another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show, today being episode number 354 with WWE Hall of Famer Pat Patterson, original air date August 25th, 2016. Pat Patterson, of course, the first ever Intercontinental Champion and one of the most influential figures behind the scenes of the WWF / WWE for the past 20, 30 years. For a very long time, he has been behind a lot of the creative finishes and match structures, as Steve will talk about in this episode. He is also responsible for creating the concept of the Royal Rumble. So you have Pat Patterson to thank for that. Steve and Pat got together to talk about Pat's book, Accepted, How the First Gay Superstar Changed WWE, which is still available on Amazon and places where you find your books. You should check that out. Talking about his book, though, and all the stuff that's in it. Talk about Pat's history working in the territories, specifically in San Francisco, Portland, the AWA, the WWWF. Also talk about some of his epic clashes with such legends as Bob Backlund, Sergeant Slaughter, working with Mad Dog Vachon, tag teaming with Ray Stevens. Lots of stuff in here for the old school fans, and just a lot of really cool stories about pro wrestling. They even talk about the Montreal Screwjob. So that's how wide we go on this episode of the Steve Austin Show. Also want to say thank you, everybody, to listening to the Steve Austin Show. Steve is back with brand new episodes every Tuesday. He is very happy with all of you being so excited that he is back on the airwaves, and he's got some great episodes up since he's returned with Tony Khan of AEW, as well as WWE Hall of Famer Mark Henry, just released this past week, so you guys should definitely catch up on those. This day in Steve Austin history, today being June 27th, we start off in 1991 for WCW in Joplin, Missouri. WCW TV champion Steve Austin defeated former champion Beautiful Bobby Eaton. In 1992, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, WCW World Champion Sting defeated WCW TV Champion Steve Austin. Then in 1993, in Knoxville, Tennessee, it's six-man tag team action with Sting, Ric Flair, and Arn Anderson defeating Lord Steven Regal and the WCW NWA Tag Team Champions Steve Austin and Brian Pillman. Then we go to the WWF in 1997 in Salt Lake City, Utah. WWF World Champion The Undertaker and Stone Cold Steve Austin defeated WWF Intercontinental Champion Owen Hart and WWF European Champion Davey Boy Smith. Then in 1999 in Greensboro, North Carolina, it is WWF King of the Ring 1999, which saw Vince McMahon and Shane McMahon defeat Steve Austin in a ladder match. Of course, this is the match where the 100% control of the WWF was in a briefcase high above the ring, and Steve Austin and the McMahons were racing up the ladder to grab those shares. A match ended when Shane grabbed the briefcase after pushing both Austin and his own father off. Now, earlier in the bout, Steve Austin had the match won, but just when he went to go reach for the case, someone raised the briefcase and it was just out of arm's reach, so Steve couldn't grab it until it was later lowered for the McMahons to win. It was never officially said who did it, but it was heavily implied that it was Big Boss Man. I am of the belief that it was Big Boss Man that raised the briefcase, because at one point he was at odds at the time with the corporation, and this was his way of getting back into their good graces. And that resulted in Vince and Shane winning 100% control of the WWF. And finally, in 2011 in Las Vegas, Nevada, this is not a Steve Austin event specifically, but it is worth noting, CM Punk unleashed his famous pipe bomb promo at the very end of Monday Night Raw, and he was wearing a Stone Cold Steve Austin t-shirt while he did it. So there's your connection. So that's it for today and this day in Steve Austin history, today being June 27th. I got my information from the history of WWE.com. All right, folks, coming right up, we've got a classic episode with the legendary Pat Patterson on the Steve Austin Show.
The end of June only means that the sports action will continue to get hotter throughout the summer in Major League Baseball, the UFC, Major League Soccer, the UFC, and more. In Major League Baseball, the Astros and the Twins are standing tall in the American League, while over in the National League, the Dodgers and the Braves keeping things interesting. Then, over in the UFC, the end of June sees the battle of the heavyweights as Francis Ngannou clashes with Junior Dos Santos. Following that up with the dominant John Jones looking to continue his winning ways against Thiago Santos at UFC 239. There's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. That's betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
You started in what year?
In the business?
Yes.
1958.
I've always known you just as Pat Patterson, the guy who was the agent and helped guys with their finish. And here's the thing. As you know, because you've been around for so many years in so many different territories, in New York specifically, guy comes in with the different agents. You know, I was kind of a Black Jack Lanza guy.
Exactly. I was going to say that, yeah.
He was a guy that kind of handled, my matches in the book. We're sitting here talking about Pat's new book. Mm-hmm. It's called Accepted. I read this thing from cover to cover, and shit, let me just backtrack, Pat. The book is mesmerizing. You live such a hell of a fun life. I mean, it had its ups and downs, high spots and your low spots.
Yeah.
But it's a very fun book to read. And I thought what we'd try to do in our conversation, given the short prep time I had for it, I could sit there and go chapter by chapter and take you through the book, but that would be giving the book away. So I just kind of wanted to pick your brain, shoot the shit, and just talk about the business and coming up.
Well, I tell you what, when you first came here, I remember that. I remember it was somewhere in San Diego or in L.A. somewhere, and you were not Stone Cold. You were...
The ringmaster,
and you went out of your mind. And I remember you were screaming at somebody and all that. And I said, I don't know what's going to happen. You hated that fucking name, did you?
Dude, they called me up. Vince called me, and I was in Atlanta. I just gotten let go, and I had a busted arm. And, I'd been working for ECW. Thankfully, Paul Heyman called me, and I got a chance to learn how to do a promo or start the learning process. Yeah. So, no, when Vince pitched me the ringmaster, I'm thinking to myself, this is the dumbest shit in the world. But it's my foot in the door because, Pat, we'll go over this in the conversation. Two times Vince had talked to me, but I knew he only wanted to bring me in as a mechanic. This time he was at least pitching me a gimmick. It was a bad gimmick,
right.
But it was a foot in the door, and the promoter wanted me. It wasn't me wanting to go because I had to, which was the case.
Right.
But as you know, you just don't want to have to make that phone call these days. So, no, I didn't like that gimmick at all because it wasn't going to go nowhere.
No, it's not you.
Yeah. And with all due respect to Ted DiBiase, who was my manager, and I got on YouTube and I watched an old match with you working with Ted. Tremendous.
Yeah, I loved it.
As good as Ted was, I just learned to start talking, so he was a hindrance. And I say that with respect because he's one of the greatest workers that I ever saw.
I see.
But that was a dead end. But my point is, so, you know, the whole time that I was here in WWE in my career, you helped me out many, many times. But you were, I wasn't in your clique. You were Rock's guy. You were everybody's guy.
Well, yeah, but
you focused on your different main guys.
I remember a few times with you, you know, and first of all, talk about Stone Cold Steve Austin. You had a character that was strong as it could be, and you were a pro. And I remember a lot of times when you were in the card, you were watching backstage, you were watching the matches. You want to see who was doing what, you know, because you don't want to do the same thing. And occasionally, sometime when you knew what you had to do for the match, and you would say, Pat, what kind of fucking shit is this? That fuck guy, God damn it. You know, Steve, calm down. Maybe we can come up with something else. Yeah, they better, you know what I mean? A few times, well, we will come up with something, you know. So this way, it's easier to come back and say, what if we do it this way or that way? Well, damn, that sounds much better, you know what I mean? And after that, you were easy to play with, you know. But we're all that way. We have a new character, and something is not working, you know what I mean? And then somebody says, what about this way? Oh, okay, you know.
But did you get the sense that I had a bad attitude?
No.
Because sometimes when I hear dealings of myself, I was a little ornery, but I mean, I was so hungry. I'd been fucked around for 7.5 years.
You were paranoid about that.
I had a chip on
that.
My shoulder.
Yeah, you were paranoid about that. And then all of a sudden you hear something and you get really upset. Did anybody else go to you and says, well, you know, calm down. Calm down. I'm going to go have a sandwich, catering, and be about an hour from now, we'll sit down and talk. You know, sometimes guys get mad, and they don't want to do this. Okay? Give me some ideas. So, I love that. Shawn Michaels, these guys. I just love to help somebody because we all get stuck. We all need to be produced.
That's what you say over and over in a book.
Yeah.
And let's go back to when you were a kid growing up in Montreal. And, dude, there was 11 family members in your house. Was it a condo or an apartment?
It was an apartment.
It was an apartment with two bedrooms.
Two bedrooms?
11 people and no running water.
Running water, with just cold water, no hot water.
Just cold water, okay, so you had to heat it up in the kitchen on the stove.
Exactly.
To take a bath.
Yeah.
But then y'all would have the bathhouses down the street.
Yeah.
And your mother
would... in the house, a two-bedroom, one kitchen, but there was one toilet.
Yeah.
No bathroom, no shower. You had to wait in line to go to the bathroom.
And then when you took a shower, your mom would give you a sliver of soap, and you go down to the public bathhouse, and then she would ask you for the sliver of soap when you got back.
Oh, yeah, you have to.
So nothing was ever handed to you.
No.
Pat, as a kid and reading a book, you're always looking for an audience.
Yes.
Why was that? I mean...
I don't know. You know, one of my brothers, he was about 2 years younger than me, and he was good at playing hockey. It wasn't me. I don't know what it is. When I was a kid, I was an altar boy, and I'm with the priest. You know, there's a big wedding, you know what I mean? Then I'm with the priest. I'm dressed like him. I give him the ensign or whatever. I'm in front of the people, you know? I like that, you know? And then later on, I watched the Ice Capade, you know? God damn, I like that. And in my neighborhood, every kid play hockey, right? I got a pair of figure skates. And I'm skating with the girls like this. Hey, you faggot! You know, because I had those kind of skates. They didn't know what it was, but I'm doing, you know. And I went for an audition when they came to Montreal. My father said, you're not going anywhere. I was too young anyway. Circus. There was a circus outdoors, you know, and I would hang around, try to go on the trapeze and everything else. I would have left with a circus, anything. I don't know what it is. I went up to perform in front of people. Don't ask me why. I don't know.
In the book, you wish you would have had the guts at that time to do it. You didn't. You waited around.
Yeah.
And just by chance, with as many family members as y'all had, I don't know what it was, because you're Catholic, right?
Yeah.
So I guess y'all started eating just bread on one day of the week, or was it on Lent on one occasion? Because this leads to you going and seeing your first professional wrestling match.
Yeah.
Tell that story, because there was a free ticket and a loaf of bread.
Oh, yeah, a loaf of bread. What I said, my mother would buy two or three loaf of bread, but once in a while there was a ticket on the, and you get a free ticket to go to the wrestling matches. I went there, and I went crazy. It was not a big place now. It was a small place, maybe 500, 600 people. I was going crazy, and I hated that villain. You have no idea. And I'm standing up, beat that shit out of him. Come on. I was going crazy. I got hooked. And then I found out later on in school, there was a kid, and his father was a promoter. He was my age. So I talked to him. I says, you're going to come to the gym that I go to. There's a place. There was a ring, and we're going to train you a little bit, you know. He said, no, my dad doesn't want us to wrestle at all. Don't worry about your dad. So I took him to the gym a few times. Then I went to his house, and I talked to his dad. I says, you know, your son, he's pretty good in the ring. What do you mean? I says, we've been training. He says, don't you talk to my son. But don't even train my son. Holy shit. And he was good, you know. So I didn't say a word. About a month later, I says, sir, why don't you give us a chance one time in the preliminary match? Well, I'll think about it. So one day he did put us in the little town first match. My God, he was so happy. And then I was in then, and all the old-timers, kid, you can ride with me, you know. And that's how I got involved in the wrestling in Montreal.
At that first match you went to, though, off the ticket from a loaf of bread, you got a chance to see Buddy Rogers, and you said when he walked, his entrance captivated you, and then his ring performance, like you said, you were going banana.
Oh, yeah.
What was it about that guy, Buddy Rogers, which was so magnetic, because he's one of the greatest stars in the history of the business? You would go on to become friends with him and wrestle him on many occasions.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Buddy Rogers, when I first saw him in Montreal, and he just walked, and he had that walk, and he looked like a star. He looked like somebody. You know what I mean? Now, about a month or two later in Montreal, I have no money to get in the building. But these guys would park their car. Buddy Rogers got the suitcase, and he's going to walk across the street. Me, carry a suitcase? All right, kid. And I walk in with them. I'm in. Kowalski, same thing. I get the suitcase. So I was, because I didn't have any money to get in. Then many years later, I'm interviewing Buddy Rogers. I'm in Japan with Kowalski. It's got a long way, you know what I mean?
But it was amazing. Tough when you're talking about carrying that suitcase, when you say, me carry suitcases, because you only spoke French.
Yeah.
Your English was the shit.
That's right. I tried. Me, suitcase. What the fuck? They don't know.
So your first lessons, because the promoter was Silvio Sampson, correct?
Yeah.
And so you find someone to teach you a little bit, but you end up basically they're stretching you more than they're teaching you.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Was it the same shit that existed years and years just to try to weed you out or not smarten you up?
Well, Dean, a preliminary match, kid, you want? They'd bring me in the ring somewhere. You wanna learn? Okay. And I go, and they stretch the hell, trying to get out of there, blowing up. You know what I mean? But I kept coming back.
The in the first few wrestling matches you had, and like you said, you guys were hitting it off. The father, the promoter, was impressed.
Yeah.
But one of the things that kept happening, a lot of your paychecks were bouncing.
Yeah.
And so your father, who you never really had the greatest relationship
with. Well, you really did read my book, did you?
I read it from cover to cover. We're going to start freelancing here in a minute, but I want to set the tone, because the biggest thing with you is you're one of the greatest minds in the history of the business.
Come on.
And especially as it pertains to the finishing sequences and stuff like that. So I just wanted to get to how you went
through all
these
processes. That's a big compliment coming from you, I'll tell you that.
That's a true story. You know it is. But so your dad, you know, the paychecks are bouncing, and your dad doesn't want you to be a professional wrestler. He says, get a real job.
Right.
What was it about the 9-to-5 grind? With all due respect to everybody that's working 9-to-5 listening to this podcast, you know, me, myself, when I got out of college and started doing this in 89, this was a job for me. When I took a test, Pat, in high school, it kind of points you in the right direction. You fill in the little circles. It said I would make a good park ranger. I didn't want to be a park ranger. So I wanted to be a professional wrestler.
Oh, God.
So what was about the 9-to-5 or just a regular job that was so abrasive to you?
I worked in the factory where they make ice skate and shoes. And that they put that on a thing, and then I might have to put them in the box. And they had all day in, day out, day in and day out. The hell, I'm not going to do that in the factory. I got fired. So I had to get another job at the cookie factory. Huge place. I lasted 3 weeks. I told her to go to hell. Yeah. That was it. My mom and dad screaming, you can't keep a job, for Christ's sake, you know. Then I tried that big factory in the behind our house, cigarette factory. It's huge. And if you get a job there, you're there for 40 years, and you're all set. You know how many times I made an appointment there? At least 50 times. And the girls goes, sir, you came here last week? No. I said, no, I know. And I'm glad they didn't take me. I'd still be there probably.
It wasn't for you?
No.
Growing up in the book, you really admired Killer Kowalski.
Yeah.
I guess you wore a purple trunk. You would wear the same when you started.
Right. God, what you was didn't it? Read the book, Steve. Nah, I can't.
Don't fuck around.
Wow.
Pat, what was about Killer Kowalski that said that he was just your hero?
He was vicious. I mean, he was mean.
Thank you.
He was mean, and he had the purple boots, purple tights, but and purple jacket. I had some made for me, man. That was like a young Kowalski. And it's a funny thing. The first time he saw me wrestle, I was in Boston, and the promoter in Boston brought in Kowalski and a couple of guys, yeah. Top guys. I said, oh, my God, I'm on the same card as Kowalski. Now I was in the locker room. I was afraid to put my boots on because I got the same thing. Maybe he's going to give me shit. What the hell is that?
Get still in my gimmick.
In fact, the promoter says to Kowalski, he says, I wasn't the first match. I said, Kowalski's going to watch you. I was a nervous wreck. A preliminary match, bing, 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 about 10, 12 minutes. And I came backstage. He said, did a good job, kid. Oh, God, I was in heaven. I was in heaven. And then later on in years, I was in Australia with him, and I was in Japan, and I tortured him. You know why?
Why?
Because he has a hard time. He's a vegetarian. He has a hard time eating, and I would order food for him that was not good. I said, here, they brought you this. I don't want that.
Another rib you pulled on him when he would go to the bathroom, you would put chicken in his rice and do stuff like that. And he'd have to reorder again.
Everything.
You were terrible.
I know.
You're one of the biggest ribbers in the history of the business.
Oh,
that's one
God.
Of the things. I have this book here, and because look at all the dog-eared pages, Pat. Those are ribs and funny stories. My book is torn up because there's so many ribs of you
we'll get
laughing
to that
your ass off.
Through
jokes, yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about the book is how you wrote it, because anybody that's ever spent any time with Pat, if you know him, it's the book is just like he's telling you the stories. He'll start getting ahead of himself, he'll go back, but wait, we'll get to that in a minute. We're still here. And so the book is
I'm
like,
relaxed. I'm having a blast now. I'm gonna tell
you
something.
Having a blast. But this is, man, other than having drinks at a bar, being in a finish room, I mean, we never really got to just hang out and shoot the shit, because you live where you do. I live where I'm at. We're both busy, but our common thread was a business. I want to go to Killer Kowalski because he was so goddamn mean. So let's segue here. One of my biggest things these days, because I want someone to learn something in the business, to learn something about the business. A heel, you, I watched many of your matches. You had a mean streak. Many heels, and I got a chance through your book. I always remember Lord Alfred Hayes from doing commentary on WWF. I didn't know that guy even worked, so I got on YouTube, and he was a nasty, vicious heel, and he made you mad because he cheated. And then when it came time to get heat on you, he was a mean prick.
Yeah.
Explain the importance of a mean streak, Pat, because to me it's so simple.
You mean as far as being mean?
Yes. You don't just go through the motions. It's with...
No, you got to...
You take pleasure, or it's a passion to fucking instill.
Exactly. When you throw a punch, your facial expression, you mean it. You just don't do it for fun.
Right.
When you grab that leg and you twist it, you got to show me that I'm twisting that. You know, that's the whole thing. The facial expression is so important.
So you're working with Silvio Samson in Montreal.
Yeah.
How long were you there before you would end up going down to Tony Santos in Boston?
Right. I was
in
Montreal. I wrestled with the kid a little bit. And then from there, I had a chance to go. Well, the promoter from Boston would come in sometime to Montreal, and he's looking for talent, you know. So I go to him. I said, you promoter? Me go Boston? He goes, yeah. He gives me his card, like trying to tell me to get out, you know what I mean? But I kept that card. And about 5-6 months later, that's when my dad threw me out of the house. And my sister, she gave me $20. In those days, it was a lot of money. I took a Greyhound bus and went to Boston. You got to go through immigration. I had nothing. In those days, I guess you didn't need a passport. And I said, me, go to Boston, wrestle. No. I was at the border 6 to 7 hours with the business card. They kept calling the promoter. Finally, the promoter answered. Well, you got a kid here that he's wrestling for you. Yeah. So I went to Boston, and then he went to Boston that way.
And you'd already started your wrestling career as Pat Patterson, because as a shoot, you are Pierre Clermont.
Yeah.
So you're already Pat Patterson, and they're waiting for you over in Boston.
I changed my name in Montreal.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Pierre Clermont. Can you imagine a name of a champion, a star? Pierre Clermont. Give me a break.
It didn't really have a really je ne sais quoi to it, if I will. Tell me how you came up with the Pat Patterson, because it's in the book.
Okay. You know what? There was two local guys. They were lumberjack. One was, what's his name? Paul Smith, and the other one was Pat Smith, two lumberjack. And I like the name Pat Smith. You know, I mean, I like the name Pat. So I take a dictionary, and the back page of the dictionary, they have the, what is it?
A surname?
Surname, yeah. So Pat, I like Pat. So now I didn't know what to call the last one. So I took the dictionary, and I closed my eyes, and I opened. The first name I saw was Patterson. Pat Patterson. That was it.
Got a ring to it.
That's been my name for years.
What changed when you went to Boston? Because you were in Boston, what, 2 years?
About 2 years, and, you know, I learned to wrestle, to travel all these little towns with different guys. They were the old-timers. They liked to play with you and trying to stretch you, but after a while, they liked to work with you. I'm not a kid. You're taking good bumps, you know, right? You know what I mean? They help you, you know, and I was there for 2 years. I had a blast. Oh, my God. I was young. I didn't know. I didn't make any money. I was living in an apartment at $10 a week.
So at this point in your life, and later on we're going to get to this, you always felt comfortable when you really started understanding the business. Whether you're working heel or babyface, you always preferred to lead the match. Mm-hmm. But I'm imagining when you get to Boston and while you're still in Montreal, or if you're working with Samson's kid, maybe you were calling a match. But I'm imagining you're still following at this point, correct, and learning?
Oh, yeah. But I learned from them. They were telling me what to do. But eventually, and I said, wait a minute, when I'm at my time, I'm going to teach these guys what to do. You know, I came to that level where they started believing in me. You know what I mean? In those days, I just wanted to lead. And some of these guys are just looking at you. Come on. You know, it just felt that way.
I don't know.
I bet you're the same way, too.
Oh, well, because I don't hear very good. I was kind of legendary, you know. If I'll never forget working with Lawler in Memphis. Yeah. You know, he was a guy that liked to start talking before you even locked up.
Right.
So he'd be trying to call the first spot, and I'd be going, what?
That.
Well, the crowd would call a high spot out to me, so it was ridiculous. I just, whether I was working heel or baby, once I got a hold of it, that's when I just started liking to lead the match.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt comfortable with.
It's funny about leading a match, you know, and that's one thing I had to do. Come on. I couldn't let a guy. Go ahead. You lead. Please, are you going to do something? You're going to kick my ass? Oh, what? Do something. You know, I'm waiting for something. No, I'm going to lead the match. I'll tell you what to do. With Rocky Johnson, I've worked with him so many times. Man, I used to give him shit every night in the ring. You lazy bastard. Get your fucking ass up. Come on. You know what I mean? I'd scream at him. Because if we have a bad match because of him, it's his fault. I don't want to have a bad match.
Right. So, going back to those formative years, man, Pat, I can't imagine there was a lot of high spots. It was a lot of holes, working for holes, healing, and then one or two spots, but it wasn't a spot fest yet.
You're right. Yeah, put a hole and make the guy suffer, you know, make him tap out. Or years ago, not too many guys would tap out. They didn't want to tap out. You know what? Get pinned, it's okay.
But going back to that day, just the fact of two guys grappling just was an attraction in and of itself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was still that time. I mean, of course, wrestling had been around in the States since before the TV was around. And then all of a sudden television comes out. It's a natural for TV. But in that day, that style just captivated people.
Oh, yeah.
Two combatants trying to wrestle for a win or for a championship belt.
Right.
And so all these years later, the business has evolved so much.
Yeah.
And
you're right. Years ago, you grab a hold. You can have a hold on the wrestler for 20 minutes. You can't get out of there. And when he does, look out. You're right.
Right.
It's true.
But today, you grab a hold for 20 minutes.
Yeah, boring.
Hey, in Boston, you're out on a town and you meet Louie.
Yeah.
Your life partner.
Yeah.
For 40 years.
Yeah.
And then so you guys become an item. And this is back in the day when the business was protected. And so y'all protected the business.
Yeah.
But you protected your relationship.
Yeah, Louis, you know, about it's a long story in a way because I met him in Boston and I would see him on weekend because he lived outside of Boston. He had a motorcycle. He'd come and spend the weekend with me and go, you know. He was a good friend, you know. But then in the meantime, Mad Dog is in Oregon. He's a star in Oregon. And I don't know how he got, still don't know today how he got my address in Boston. He sends me a letter.
Your book in 2 weeks in Oregon. You better be here.
Mad Dog wants me to go to Oregon. I had no idea where Oregon is. Then I go to the promoter in Boston. I tell him I want to go to Oregon. He takes a map. I've never seen him back that big. He's like, you're going from coast to coast. To me, it was like going around the world. And he says, you could starve to death. That scared me. I didn't go. About 3 weeks later, I got a letter from Mad Dog.
You better get your fucking ass over here.
Oh, my God. Now I have to go. I borrowed money from Louis, flew to Portland, got a little apartment. I stayed in a hotel. Mad Dog was there. So about a couple of weeks later, I miss my friend Louis, and Louis flies in.
But you were just thinking, hey, man, when you said goodbye to Louis, you know, you were just going to go do your thing.
I didn't think I was ever going
to
see him, no.
And he was going to go do his thing. Yeah. That's Pat Patterson's phone going off. Yeah. Anytime someone's phone's going off, they owe me a beer and you a beer. So Pat Patterson owes you a round.
I'm sorry.
There's a lot of noise. We're right here at the Staples Center. Pat doesn't know how to work his iPhone. This is classic clusterfuck material here on the Steve Austin Show. But you didn't figure, you just figured it was over. You'd never see him again.
No, I never thought I would see him again. But God damn it, after a while, I'm all alone, you know. I'm in a hotel room, you know, and one of the boys would pick me up and all that stuff, you know. And I asked him to come to Portland. He quit his job and left his family, everything. I mean, he had a good job in that little little town there. So we're sitting in the lobby of the hotel. I never forget that. On a Sunday night, who comes walking in? Mad Dog. My friend Louis, when he saw Mad Dog, because he heard of Mad Dog before. Mad Dog comes walking in and he's drunk. And Louis sees Mad Dog, he runs out the fucking door.
You brought your boyfriend with you, did you?
I says, well, he's my friend.
Where did he go?
I says, Maurice, I don't know. You got scared.
Well, we'll go find him.
I said, oh, my God. Get in the car. We're driving all the way downtown Portland from one street to the other. And he's going, where the hell is he? Where the hell is he? I said, dog, I don't know. Turn here, turn there. Then he sees him on the sidewalk. He puts the window down and says, get in the car. Louis keeps running. Yeah. He steps on the gas and gets on the sidewalk, blocks him. Get in the car! He gets in the car.
We're going to go to the bar and talk.
I figure he's going to prepare to kill both of us. We were scared of that. We're sitting. He's talking with Louis more than me. And they never shut up talking. Became the best friend.
And they become very good friends. But and this would end up being the case because Louis would, your wrestling always came first.
Yeah, always.
And he would end up following you to all of the territories.
Yeah.
And everybody that he met just loved Louis.
Yeah.
And so he was just a natural, charismatic guy and just a great person.
Yeah.
So everybody loved him.
Yeah.
And honestly, so I just thought
it's not because he's my friend. He was better than me, for Christ's sake.
But he was a cool guy.
But anyway, about Mad Dog.
Yeah. But tell me about how over Mad Dog Vachon was, because I've always heard the stories, and I didn't get a chance to see a whole lot of his work, but I just knew that he was very feared and had a ton of heat.
Oh, what unbelievable. But he was, when you watch him work, and he's beating the shit out of you,
right?
You know he is.
Right.
You know, it's like the facial expression. And I mean, God, he was unbelievable. And you know what? When I went to Oregon, he wrestled a guy by the name of, what's his name? Oh, Nuts Thomas. Anyway, a black wrestler. He was very good. And I'll never forget it. In Seattle, he had a one-hour match. I've never seen that before. A one-hour match. Luther Lindsay. Mad Dog versus Luther Lindsay. A one-hour match. I didn't know the match was going to last an hour. I could not believe at the end of the match, people were going insane. I've never seen that. I couldn't believe it. First time you see an hour match together.
Right, right.
God, you should have seen that match. These guys that were both wrestlers, they wrestled. Mad Dog sometimes would go crazy and they'd come back into the wrestling. Oh, it was unbelievable.
So why did you consider, because Don Owens was running Portland.
Yeah.
And so he was a promoter. And you started in Montreal, went to Boston. But you consider Portland to really be where you kind of started feeling your oats or feeling your own.
Yeah.
You had television exposure. You were getting over.
Yeah.
At what year was this in the business? Why were you? Who was teaching you? What was clicking with you? Was it the reps? Was it the time in the ring?
And one of the guys I worked with, you know, and some of the old timers, and I took a lot of bumps for there and everything else. And I've learned all that. But some guys, and Portland's a nice little territory. For example, Nick Bockwinkel was there at one time. Pepper Martin was a good worker, and he was there. So all these guys that I didn't know, you know what I mean? And Pepper Martin goes to a promoter one night. He says, let me work a program with the kid. God damn it, he's good. So Pepper Martin was a top baby face. We couldn't wait to work with each other. First match we had, it stunk. He's talking to me in the ring. I can't do that. I'm talking to him. He does not listen to me. He says, Pepper, next time, let me lead the match. And after that, we became the best of friends. He was so good.
Tell me the story about Nick Kozak, because in your book you said this guy could sell his ass.
Oh, my God.
He taught you a different level of work, because this dude would sell.
Yeah.
And because he was so great at selling, the people would go crazy when he made his comeback.
You know what
you
just...
But that was an eye-opener for you at that time in your life.
Exactly. Put a reverse headlock on him, and you hold on to it, and you know, he's trying. He's almost got it. Yeah, he's got to pull the hair. My God, they go crazy. He pulled the hair. No. Hey, sometime for 15 minutes, and he would fight it and fight it back down. I said, you got to get out. Don't worry. Stay there, you know. Then when he came out, man, oh, Jesus, that was that easy.
Make sure to stick around after this podcast to get the latest headlines from the AP News Minute.
Hey there, Rob Cesternino from Rob Has a Podcast. And if you're a Big Brother fan, you know the summer is all about one thing, watching crazy people locked in a house on Big Brother. And we've got episode recaps after every episode with the past house guests talking about all the updates from the game and the gossip from the live feed. Listen to Rob Has a Podcast exclusively on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. And if you love the show, why don't you share it or even leave us a rating and review?
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
So you were in Portland, what, about 18 months?
Yeah, maybe a couple of years, yeah. A
couple of years. And then you go to San Francisco to work for Roy Shire and Big Time Wrestling in 65.
Yeah.
So I got to hear about Roy Shire, because I heard that he was just a cantankerous guy. He watched every single match at every single show, and he was always yelling. Mm-hmm. Is this true? Please explain to me about this Roy Shire.
Yes, sir.
He didn't initially like you.
No, at first he didn't like me.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, at first he did not like me at all.
Not at all.
But you know the story that I told him before I got there, right?
No.
Oh, you didn't know that. I was in Portland, and in Portland, Pepper Martin used to work in San Francisco a couple of years before that. Nick Bockwinkel has worked there before. So these guys are telling me, said, Pat, you ought to go to San Francisco. And you and Ray Stevens would make a good team. I didn't even know Ray Stevens. I says, well, I don't know. Well, you should go there, you know. So I did the usual thing, send pictures, you know. And then I call Roy Shire about a week or two later, and I says, Mr. Shire, I says, I'd like to work for you and have a date. You know, Nick Bockwinkel told me it'd be good. And Pepper Martin said, we'd make a good tag team. He says, the boys don't do what I – no, I do
I tell the boys what to do. They don't tell me.
Exactly right. You know, so I said, okay, no problem. So he gave me a date, and I went to San Francisco. My first night, I had a little apartment in San Francisco. So how are you going to go to Fresno? It's 200 miles from San Francisco to Fresno to do TV. So I ride with him in his pickup truck. Got a pickup truck. He's got a gun, you know. He got a big wrench anyway. So I go to do TV. And after we're done TV, I get in the truck with him. I'm having a few beers. He goes, you better start working out. You look like shit. I said, holy Christ almighty. You know, I wasn't really into workout thing, you know. And then he says, I heard some of them shit about you. I says, what'd you hear? He says, well, you're different. I says, what do you mean different? He says, you're different. I says, well, I'll tell you, I'm gay. He says, you dumb shit, you admit it? I says, Roy, I'm going to work for you. You might as well fucking know. He said, you're stupid. I says, I'm not. I'm just telling you I'm honest with you. So now I got home. My friend Louis is waiting for me. I says, I don't think we're going to be here too long.
Right.
He told me about workout, and he's telling me about being gay. Jesus Christ. I was there 15 years.
Yeah, I know. It is on the, first of all, before we get to the back end, because this is when he would start helping you or dropping finishes on you or just discussing finishes with you. But before that, you finally ended up doing what you said you were going to do. You hooked up with Ray Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
Y'all turned into the Blonde Bombers.
Oh.
And if you go to the Wikipedia page, when you look up Cow Palace, you know, about the middle of a thing, also that happened at the Cow Palace, professional wrestling with Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson, among others, would sell out all the time.
Yeah.
So tell me about Ray Stevens, because I didn't see enough of his work, but everybody swears by that guy.
I swear to God, this guy was always a 15-year-old. No matter how old he was 15 or 18 years old. He was a party guy. He was a fun guy, you know. If his wife asked him to go get a loaf of bread, he'd come back 2 days later with the bread. He was a party guy, I'm telling you. And in the ring, I'll tell you what, he was so good. He could have a match with his eyes closed. And then we're a tag team now. I says, Ray, what are you going to do? You want to start? He says, you just call it. Don't worry. I'll follow. You know, he just didn't worry about anything. He was loved by the boys. There's no question. The guys liked to work with him. He was fun to be with.
But that's one of the things also just with your relationship with him. You guys are spending so much time together. Well, no matter what it was, he goes, you would ask him, Ray, what do you want to do? He goes, whatever you
want
to do.
Whatever you want, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just easy.
No problem. And he's in the ring, you know, where we're working our ass up. He's laughing in the corner. You know what I mean?
At that point in your career, when you guys are starting to get white hot, and he's over laughing in the corner, had you learned that you can have a good time in the ring? Because for me, for my first 5 years, I was so dead serious. I didn't think you were allowed to have fun in there.
Yeah.
And when I was able to have fun, boy, that's when it really blew up.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned that from Ray.
Yeah.
You're having fun working. It's unbelievable. The joke that you can do in the ring with the boys, you don't have no idea what we're doing. It's great. You know, we have fun.
Hey, let's talk about the Cow Palace a little bit, because that building was built in, I think, 1941, and it was the original home of what is now the Golden State Warriors. So, give or take, that building was 25 years old when you get there. When I got there in the 90s, it was a cold, stark building from my memories, and kind of wide open. And it was cold because they also played hockey there, so they'd have the cardboard sheets on top of the ice.
Oh, it was awful.
Sometimes when they set the ring in there. So it was a brutal place to work, but the fans were hardcore. Hardcore to the point back in the day, you guys would get so much heat that y'all were afraid for your fucking lives.
I'm lucky to be alive. How long from the dressing room to the middle of the ring? Oh, my God. And trying to get out of there if you just cheated to win the championship?
Right.
Forget it. Yeah, there was riots many times. I mean, many times. One time I thought I was going to die, really. Crazy.
You told.
And I'm wrestling Peter Mavia. He's a god. I mean, he is a real god, you know?
Yeah.
And that night I pulled a brass knock and I knocking him. Roy Shire, I said, I'm not going to do that. He said, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. And, Jesus Christ. Boom. Peter is bleeding all over the place. Who do you think comes in the ring? All them Samoans. Afa, Sika. They're killing me.
Yeah.
He saved my life, Peter. He really did. I swear to God. These guys. And then Sika was the one really crazy. Like, we see that 3-4 weeks later, I'm wrestling a return match. Sika is way up in as far as you can go, because he was not allowed to come down. There I am, beating the shit out of Peter Mavia. Here he comes. And no one could stop him. It was dangerous. Jesus.
What was it about? In your book, you call two people wrestling geniuses. You call Roy Shire Eddie Graham down in Florida.
Yeah.
Now, as you first started off in San Francisco, Roy didn't like you in the beginning, but then y'all had your meeting. He understood. He accepted you. It's the name of the book. You've always been accepted. Yeah. And he knew that you would work your ass off and high integrity, go out there and do what you set out to do. So then in the later years, he would start asking you your opinion on finishes. And this is one of the great finish guys in the history of the business. How did this help mold your model or your acumen when coming up with a finish? Because now you're getting one of the great minds and he's asking you.
Mm. I know. It's like any, I don't know how you'd say that. Whether it's Vince McMahon and he's got to make a decision, we should do it this way, we should put that match there. You have to make decision. After a while, you do that day in, day out, you ask somebody their opinion. What do you think? You think we should have this match later or earlier? Should we have this match going this way? Because after a while, you need to. It's no different than a wrestler, you know. He knows what he wants to do in the ring, but I'm not sure. Maybe I should ask somebody. This way you feel good instead of walking in there, God damn it, you know.
But that's going back to taking it like you say many times in the book, wrestlers need to be produced. It's the greatest of the greats. They need feedback.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, you know, they get such, maybe so the old saying, they get so far in the woods, they can't see the trees. So, you know, they need to be produced. Like I could be stone cold, but sometimes, you know, maybe you would come up to me or Blige, I would say, hey, think about this. And I'd be like, okay, I'm straight ahead. And here comes this alternative. It's like, oh, that's a good idea. Let me broaden my horizon and open up my mind to being able to try that and experiment with that and grow.
Yeah.
Because if you're not produced or don't have any feedback, you know, how do you get better?
Yeah. You know, and sometimes also there's too many ideas at one time. Somebody said, well, I don't think you should do it this way. Then you bring it back to somebody and say, yeah, I think we should do it the other way. Now you get really confused. There's 3-4 guys tell you what to do. You're mixed up. And the same thing with when I used to work with Vince at the office and being creative, you know, when it came down to the Royal Rumble, Vince, he said, forget about that, Pat. It's not going to work. I said, Vince, it's got to work. All right, you don't want to, you're going to do it. And I would bring it up, you know. And sometime he'd say, okay, we'll think about it, you know. It's... You can't do everything and you need help with somebody, you know. It's like, the one-hour match with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. He wasn't about to do that. No way. A one-hour match on a pay-per-view. A lot of the guys can't work. It's, you know, right, 1 hour. So, Vince, you got 2 kids that can tear the house down. Oh, Pat, please forget about it, you know. But eventually it came out. Probably sometimes it takes them a little while to digest. Well, let me think about that, you know. You can't have an answer for every question. Maybe you have an answer a little bit later. You have to be patient. You know, it's beautiful. I love it. You know, I like when somebody asks me for my opinion, for an idea, you know. Even if it's just a little thing that looks bad. You know, it's the hardest thing what the guys have is if you're a top guy and there's something that you do in the ring that doesn't look good, who's going to tell you that? Not too many. But I like to do that. I've done it with Cena many times. And John, you think of Lumpy, you die.
There was. Yeah.
You know? Really? Yeah. Okay. If you want to do it, fine, you know?
There was someone in the book, I think they were fixing to leave into another territory, and I think it was your kicks in the turnbuckle that weren't looking so great. No, you were telling this to somebody else. It was Hogan. Was it?
Hogan, yeah.
Yeah, you told, maybe someone told you earlier in your career. But
I was in Montreal. I was not in Montreal. I was in Florida, and he was in Montreal. I think he was in Montreal, and he was working with somebody. But anyway, I called him, and he answered, and I said, Terry, you all set? Yeah, I'll be all right. I says, remember now, you don't have to go crazy. I says, just do what you do and do it well. That's all you have to do. You're Hogan. Okay, brother. Then apparently you put the phone down. He said, motherfucker, he said, that son of a bitch is great. You know what I mean? Just a little touch that he needed. you know.
Hey, towards the end of your run in San Francisco, you were kind of – you weren't office, but you damn near were office and working for Roy Shire.
Right.
He couldn't make a battle roll one time.
Oh, he had a battle roll every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every. Maybe – was the Royal Rumble born from maybe – because the way you invented it was different than Roy Shire's, but were the seeds planted in those early battle rolls working in big-time wrestling?
They were just those days. It was just a regular battle royal.
Right.
20 guys. You're number two, number three,
right.
And that's it. It was not one after the other. You all go in, ding, ding. It was just a battle royal. But I always wanted. I have some stories from old timers that I heard. Okay, a battle royal. Somebody came up with that somehow. No one knew. I have no idea. Nobody knows who invented the battle royal.
You're right. I don't either.
I don't know. So I kept saying I'd like to create a battle royal. When I came up with the idea, you know, one guy and two guy, you know, Vince, are you fucking crazy? Come on, you know. Listen.
He thought it was a shit.
He hated it.
And then y'all go do the Saturday night special or whatever it was.
Yeah, Dick Ebersol.
Dick Ebersol.
Yeah. And, we have to give him the card. Hogan's going to sign a contract. And then a tag team championship match. And Dick Ebersol said, well, it's a good card. It's on USA Network, you know, no network, but USA Network. It's not really all. Something is missing, and Vin says, "Why don't you tell him that stupid idea?" And I gave him the concept. I didn't have a name.
I know, but you said it. First of all, it's not stupid. I think it's great.
That's
and
right.
Dick Ebersol listened to
stupid
it. And he
idea.
Loved it.
Yeah. He said, "Pat, tell him that your stupid idea." I said, first of all, it's not a stupid idea. I give him the how it's going to work. I didn't have a name for it. He says, oh, my God, this is legal running. That sounded good.
Yeah.
Well, and Vince says, oh, we'll think about it, you know, think about it. But we did it.
Yeah. And it's funny because there was no name for the match. It needed something spectacular to call it. So, like 50 people from the office, or they submitted 50 ideas, and Royal Rumble was one of them.
Exactly.
And so it became known as the Royal Rumble.
Exactly.
And turned into a pay-per-view event.
Yeah.
So you end up finishing up with Roy Shire, and it's time to go somewhere else. You went down to Florida. You worked for wrestling genius Eddie Graham. Johnny Valentine, I think, had the book.
Yeah.
You and Johnny weren't on the same page.
No, not at all.
But what about Eddie? I always heard that this guy was a genius in the business. What made this guy so smart?
Well, he had the great psychology of the business, and he's a lot of these guys that work down there, and they learned the business from Eddie. But Eddie was just like really like the old school. You know what I mean? It was not like the ha-ha and everything else. It was just the old school, you know, just work a hole and work a hole, and blah, 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 you know what I mean? It was not all the flying and that we do today. He was very good. He had very good ideas. And I heard years ago, Roy Shire, Eddie Graham, there was another promoter. They always talked to each other. Dory Funk, yeah. They always talked to each other, you know. Get any ideas and blah, 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 you know what I mean? So in Florida, I had a blast there. Dusty Road there, the Briscoes. Oh, I had a great time with it.
But you didn't stay there very long.
No, a couple of years. I was a booker for about 6 months. Not for me.
No?
No.
How did the first booking session go?
Huh?
What was the problem with it?
Well, there's a lot of local guys there, you know, the Briscoes and names, blah, blah. I was not the booker. I'm sorry. The assistant booker with Valentine. He was, I'm going to clean up house. I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to tired of all these guys. This is myself. That's not going to work. It didn't, you know, because you wanted to change everything. And Valentine is a slow, maybe, don't know, didn't work.
Well, what about him as a heel in the ring?
He'd grab a hole and you just sit in it and wait. Wait till he gets off of it. That's it.
Okay, so you're there for a while, and then you put a phone call in to Vern to work for the AWA in Minnesota.
That was Ray. Ray trying to bring me up.
Right.
Yeah.
So how was Vern?
Well, isn't that funny? I've worked in San Francisco for years, had a big name and everything else. And Vern Gagne says, well, you got blonde hair. I said, yeah. He says, well, you have two guys with blonde hair over here. You're going to have a different color. I said, well, I ain't going. I ain't changing my color. And a week later, he said, all right, you know, so now Ray was, knew I was coming, and I had a blast in Minneapolis. Louis was there, too.
What was the style in the ring in AWA all the way up there in Minneapolis? Was it different than the places that you'd been from Montreal, Boston, Portland?
Basically the same. Now, wait a minute. You know, in those days, it was Vern Gagne, the Bruiser, the Crusher. These were the guys, you know what I mean? And so there was a lot of wrestling, lots of wrestling. They liked a lot of wrestling. Vern liked him, get behind, go in the bang. I don't know. There was not that many flying, you know.
Right. In your career, I always think you took chances. You know, I mean, it was a chance coming from Montreal down to Boston.
Yeah.
And then from Boston all the way across the globe, like the promoter told you. And then Vachon had written you a letter. You didn't go the first time, but you went the second time. And so you are always willing to take a gamble. You are always willing to take a risk. You are always willing to push. You had to. And you did. But after your time in the AWA, you requested a meeting with Vern Gagne because – as laid back as Ray Stevens was, you wanted to know what a promoter's plans for you were because you were thinking in the here and you were thinking in the future.
Yeah.
And so Vern tells you, he goes, I don't tell my secrets. And, you know, since Ray went with the flow, you needed to know. You said,
I don't tell my secret.
Yep. And he said he wouldn't tell you. And you said, fine, I won't tell you my secrets.
That's right.
But the secret was...
New York.
You had a secret ace in the sleeve with Vince Sr. Yeah. How did that transpire?
Great. Mike LaBelle was a promoter in Los Angeles, and they were friends and everything else. And Mike LaBelle calls me. He said, Vince wants you in New York. I said, me going to New York? Give me a break, for Christ's sake. I never dreamed of that. And I knew that the thing with Ray and I in Minneapolis is we had enough, you know what I mean? So I told Ray, I said, I have a chance to go to New York. He said, go, goddamn go. I said, well, that's what I told Vern. You have any plans for us? I don't tell my plans. I said, I got plans too, but I ain't going to tell you either. See, I got to know. I said, no, you tell me yours. And I told him, I says, I'm going to New York. That's it.
So Vince's plan, Vince Sr.'s plan, he wanted you, was it right out of the gate? He wanted to work for back-to-back-to-back-to-back shots in Madison Square Garden with Bob Backlund as champion?
Yeah, well, he brought me to New York to work with Backlund, but back-to-back, I don't think he was sure. He didn't know.
Oh.
I mean, if the first one is no good, you ain't going to go with the second one.
Right.
Because in New York, you got to sell out or you got to have a crowd. First match I worked with Backlund, it was like the old man. He was so happy. Then go to another one. Then go to another one. Then I went four with Backlund.
That's unheard of.
It was not a picnic. It was not a picnic.
What are you saying, Pat? Here's the thing. What were you thinking? Because you're a creative guy. You like to, you know, you take bumps. You like to really get your baby face over. Bob's a former shooter.
Yeah.
What was the chemistry in the ring? Did he understand what you wanted to do or your vision?
He was told, when I tell you, do it. That's it. He had to listen to every word I say. I had it made because Vince says, listen to Pat. But he had the mentality, you know, shooting.
Right.
He was always afraid that somebody's going to double cross him. He wrestled with some big guys.
Right.
You know what I mean? I swear to you, in the cage match, he swore that I was going to double cross him. I asked him, he was pulling on me. God, I'm over the cage and I'm pulling it. I asked him, I said, but you fucking shooting with me or what? He says, well, I don't know. I thought you were trying to. Yeah.
That's interesting to know that mindset, just because I can understand back in those days. I mean, because fast forward a couple of years, I mean, because the Montreal Screwjob would happen.
Yeah.
We'll get that in a minute. But I can see where that paranoia would come from.
I know.
One guy left out, I'd like to take it back just to when I must have been Portland. I think you were working with the legendary Pat O'Connor, who was at the time the National Wrestling Alliance world champion.
I love Pat O'Connor, yeah.
I know, you're a big idol.
Yeah.
But when you guys, I mean, you were a big fan of his. But when you guys went out there, the matches weren't so much. And because he was the legendary Pat O'Connor, you trepidatiously said, Pat, may I have a conversation with you and you won't get mad at me?
Right.
He said, yes. And so you said, just do you mind if I lead the match? He goes, we'll tear the place down. Right. Just let me do my thing.
Yeah.
And let me think about it. He thought about it, and then you went out and tore the house.
Oh, my God, and I loved it. Yeah.
So what was it about Pat O'Connor? Because I never got a chance to see a lot of film on that guy.
Well, he's, you know, dingy gang, ba ba bang, ba ba bang, roll around. Okay, kid, what are you going to do now? I go, God damn. But I see, when I watched him work before, and I said, geez, I'd like to work with him. And then after that match that we had, he was at the bar, and he was a guy that, the tightest guy in the business, believe me. And I said, I'd like to buy you a beer, okay? He says, no, no, I'll buy you the beer. I almost had a heart attack, for Christ's sake. Yeah, it was nice, you know.
Hey, what was the deal with the, when they, in 79, when you were crowned the first Intercontinental Champion? Because I was at one time the Intercontinental Champion. I got dropped on my head defending that belt. And that original belt that was there for a while, through a lot of badass hands, is in my safe. You were the first IC Champion.
Yeah.
But you were never in, where was it, Rio? Where was it? Rio de Janeiro.
In
Rio de Janeiro, but you're the IC Champion.
Don't ask me what date and what day.
And you know, it's only fitting that that belt would start off with a hellacious worker, because some of the best workers in the history of the business, at times, that IC belt was the belt to go see.
That's true. I never thought of it that way. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of times, you know, the world champion was the world champion, but that the workers were the ones carrying that IC strap, and I was just so coveted to me, and you were the first one.
Oh, God. Another thing that I got to say it. It's Sergeant Slaughter, the LA fight.
Dude, in 1981, we got to talk about that. I watched that match three times the other day.
Jesus, you're kidding. Was he selling or what?
Oh, my God. Huh? But just the magic that happened on the turnbuckle when gets the job done in action, not on a mat, while he's flying, hits one, and he's just... busted wide open.
Oh, my God. And he's falling down on one knee, and he wants to fight. And he was so good.
But both of you guys were selling in such epic fashion. And if
the difference.
That's the difference.
Selling.
I know you're here now today, and you still work with WWE hands-on. You file reports about what you see. You still talk to the superstars. You talk to me. You took The Rock under your wing. You've mentored so many guys in the business. Now when you think, Pat, are we selling too little now? Has the business gotten so fast that we can't slow down a little bit? Where are we?
Well, they're going too fast, my opinion,
Let's fast forward. Montreal screw job. You maintain in the book you had nothing to do with it.
Absolutely.
Straight up shoot.
Oh, yeah. Shoot. if I had, I would have said, yeah, I had no choice to be part of it. I did not know. Steve, let me tell you, I was watching the match because I always liked it. And there's a curtain. Owen is there. And what's his name?
David Boy.
There. Well, and we're watching the match, and all of a sudden, holy shit. And they go, what the hell is this? I had no idea. Now I'm freaking out. And I look at Gorilla. Before there was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
There was not that many that there. Some people knew, but I didn't know. I don't know what to do. I'm freaked out, honest to God. I didn't even go see Vince. So I took my suitcase, my briefcase, and went downstairs in the parking lot. I'm fucking quitting. I got in the car. And I went to the hotel across the street, have a few drinks, and that's it. I'm quitting. I was shocked, honest to God. Now I'm drinking, and I'm there about a half an hour, 40 minutes. Then I start thinking, I look like I'm running away. You know, I'm afraid. I got to go back. I get in the car. I go all the way upstairs. By the time it's about a half an hour, 45 minutes later, where's Brett? He's in his room. So I start walking. Somebody said to me, don't go in there now. Tell it to be trouble. I said, I'm going. They said, Vince was there earlier. I says, I don't care. I'm going to go talk to Brett. And I knocked on the door. Who's that? It's Pat Patterson. They opened the door, and I went to Brett. He was sitting down. And I said, Brett, goddamn, I had nothing to do with it. If you believe me, shake my hand. If you don't, you know how much I fucking helped you over the years. I didn't know. I did not know. And he wouldn't shake my hand. And I left. And the next day we're in Ottawa. Oh, my God. I was I was, even the boys were a little upside down.
Well, it was
down,
strange because, you know? I hadn't been in a company real
night.
Long.
Huh?
I thought, man, when Brett got screwed and then he was going to go down to WCW, and I was just thinking, what are we going to do with that? The one and only Bret Hart. You know, Bret Hart was a big part of my career.
Right.
Man, I love that guy.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what are we going to do without Bret?
Yeah.
Because I just thought that much of him.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, everything transpired and everything ended up okay. But there was a lot of bad blood there forever. Finally, finally, you were able to break through and make peace with Bret, right?
It took a long time.
Yes, many years.
2 or 3 years, I think. Yeah.
What would you have thought had you been in his boots that night?
I don't know.
I mean, that's ultimate betrayal, right? But, I mean, but by not wanting to do business, I mean, the promoter has to do the promoter has to do.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, you say this in the book many times, Pat. This is sports entertainment.
Yeah.
So everybody knows that.
Yeah.
But to us, it's real.
Yeah.
And so Bret was so real about that and his fan base in Canada that he had made up his mind that he could not drop the belt there anywhere else. But not
I thought
there.
I was wrong on his part, big time, big time. So what do you do? Vince had to do what he has to do.
Right.
I don't blame Vince. No, after at first you go, what the hell did he do that for? Oh, my God. After a while you digest it and you know the reason why he had to do it.
Right.
You know, but I didn't know. The funniest thing is that in the afternoon they're sitting down together, you know, and I'm there and sit down with them, blah blah blah. I'm in there talking and walk away. And now I know why they were talking, because I think Sean knew it, but I didn't. So they're all getting along. That was Vince. How they doing? Doing great. Back there talking spot. Great. Okay. I had known nothing.
As good as the Iron Man match was in 60 minutes, I think they added a few minutes to it. There was never any love lost between those guys.
I don't think at that time there was.
I think they were so competitive.
Yeah.
I think they weren't mad at each other, but I just think they were so competitive that was an awesome match. But then after that, you know, the screw job, I think that there was a divide, but I guess in the video that they did, and the DVD, I guess, now that they've come full circle. Pat, I love the book. And I'm going to say this. I had a shit pile of notes on my computer, and I didn't get through half of them. And there's many more stories in this book, and it's a ride that will take you up and down, and you will laugh out loud on some of the stories of the ribs that Pat played. But it's a book. It's written from the heart. I didn't want to just go straight from the book. I wanted to talk about some of the promoters that Pat had worked for, because there's some great learning lessons in there. But if you have any kind of passion for the business, or if you just want to hear about a story about a guy that was gay who reached about the highest level you could reach in the business of professional wrestling, a macho, badass, tough business, I suggest you read Accepted by Pat Patterson, because I enjoyed the shit out of it. And it was able for me, Pat, as long as I've known you, as much as you've helped me to read your story, and goddamn, you had a hell of a life. And for all the things that you had to hide, you always made chicken salad out of chicken shit. You did. And so the glass is always half full.
Yeah.
And Louie, wonderful Louie, for 40 years, and God rest his soul, he passed away. I didn't go into that. But you guys just did your thing, and y'all blended with everybody, and people loved you.
Yeah.
I love you.
Steve.
Thanks for talking to me.
Can you imagine Stone Cold? Macho man loves me.
SOB in the history of the business, goddammit.
Isn't that beautiful? Wow, this is the compliment.
Let's get some props to our friends over at TrueCar for supporting the podcast from day one. With TrueCar, 60 seconds is all you'll need to get an offer for your car. And the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, and do a few push-ups, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or even from home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up.
Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate TrueCash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you. Together, you can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then, simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. TrueCash offer not available in all areas. Hey, we here at the Steve Austin Show have a favorite four-letter F word. Free, F-R-E-E. That's why it's our privilege to introduce you to your new favorite streaming service, Pluto TV. Believe us, you're going to dig it. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. There's also a ton of options for sports, with pro wrestling and MMA available. Pluto TV never asks for a credit card. You don't even need to sign up to watch free. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies for free. And the best part, you can download Pluto TV for free on all your favorite devices today, including your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smart TVs, PlayStation, and anywhere else you stream. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. Get more info at Pluto.tv. All right, I'm giving Sean a go-home cue, so let's wrap it up for this week. Make sure you check out podcast1.com and subscribe to the Steve Austin Show so you don't miss any of these classic episodes. Before I ride off in the sunset, I do want to throw out a couple of plugs. I still got a beer. It's the Badass Broken Skull IPA, the finest IPA in the United States of America, and that's the bottom line. Made by El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find Broken Skull IPA at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in Cali. If you ain't in Cali, you're probably SOL. And if you're looking to get a badass pocket knife, I got two for you. Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife, Cold Steel Working Man Knife. Get them at my Amazon store, amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin, or go to the Cold Steel Knives website and check out all their badass knives. Also, one more big shout out to all my sponsors to make this show possible. That's how I'm able to bring this show to you free twice a week. Please support them because they support us. For more info, check out the podcast description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at Steve Austin BSR. My name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.